All right, here's a question. How many men are gay?
About 5%.
Does advertising work?
Yes.
Why was American Pharoah a great racehorse?
Big left ventricle.
Is the media biased?
Yeah, it gives you what you want to read.
Are Freudian slips real?
No.
Who cheats on their taxes?
Everybody who knows how to cheat.
Who is this person? And how does he know these things? That's what you'll find out on this episode of Freakonomics Radio, that and a lot of other things, some of which are pretty disturbing. For instance, how Google searches for a particular racial epithet can spike after certain events.
There was a big increase in searches when Obama was elected.
It turns out that Google search data can tell us a lot about ourselves that we may not even tell ourselves.
People just are in such a habit of lying in their day-to-day life. People lie to their, partners or their kids or their parents.
And when you drill down into this ruthlessly honest database, you're bound to be surprised.
It feels like kind of a confessional window where people just type statements with no reason that Google would be able to help.
This is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
There have been quite a few prominent terrorist attacks in recent years.
An explosion at the Stade de France, north of Paris.
Berlin, early this morning. A weapon of mass murder is slowly removed.
Today, London suffered a horrific attack near Parliament Square.
Many of these attacks have one thing in common.
The enemy is, in fact, radical Islam, an ideology.
Afterward, politicians tend to encourage unity.
London is the greatest city in the world, and we stand together in the face of those who seek to harm us and destroy our way of life.
And they encourage us to not equate Islamist terrorism with Islam.
The attacks have nothing to do with Islam, which is followed peacefully by millions of people around the world.
How effective is this sort of encouragement?
Okay, do you want to just tell me if I'm talking too long?
That is Seth Stevens-Davidowitz.
I'm an economist, a data scientist, and an author.
And he has studied the effectiveness of this kind of political speech. This speech, for instance.
Good evening. On Wednesday,
President Obama was responding to a terrorist attack in San Bernardino, California. A Muslim husband and wife shot and killed 14 people and seriously injured another 22.
We cannot turn against one another by letting this fight be defined as a war between America and Islam.
The speech was really, I thought, beautiful and kind of moving.
It's our responsibility to reject proposals that Muslim Americans should somehow be treated differently. Because when we travel down that road, we lose.
He talked about how important religious tolerance has been to America, and how everyone has a responsibility to, you know, not give in to fear, but really appeal to freedom. And everybody has a responsibility to not judge people based on their religion and not give religious tests when deciding who enters this country.
Shortly after the San Bernardino attack, Stevens-Davidowitz and a colleague, Evan Soltas, published a piece in the New York Times called The Rise of Hate Search. The primary evidence came from Google search data.
So search like kill Muslims and I hate Muslims and Muslims are evil, or, you know, really nasty searches.
They looked at the frequency of that kind of search before, during, and after Obama's speech.
We were founded upon a belief in human dignity.
It was a very, very well-received speech.
So did the speech curtail anti-Muslim Google searches?
We found that all the searches during the speech actually went up, where he was saying that it was our responsibility to reject fear and it is our responsibility to not judge people based on religion.
Let's make sure we never forget what makes us exceptional.
But, you know, searches against Syrian refugees were going up, and searches to kill Muslims were going up, and searches for I hate Muslims were going up. So it seemed like everything that Obama was doing, even though all the traditional sources were saying that he was doing a great job, was actually backfiring in terms of its real goal, which was to calm an angry mob that had been inflamed by these San Bernardino attacks.
So the book you've written is called Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. I understand that's not the title you were wanting.
The title that I wanted for my book was How Big Is My Penis? What Google Searches Reveal About Human Nature. My publisher was like, people would be embarrassed to buy that in an airport.
And what share of the data that you're writing about in the book is Google data? You have other sources as well.
Yeah, it's not all Google data. I use data from anonymous and aggregate data from Pornhub. I scraped some websites. So I scraped a hate site, Stormfront. I scraped Wikipedia. I use some Facebook advertising data and some other sources.
And just tell us quickly your academic background, what you studied and where.
I have a BA in philosophy from Stanford and a PhD in economics from Harvard. I was getting my PhD and I found that Google had released basically data on searches, where people made searches, when people made searches. And I kind of became obsessed with this data to the point I really couldn't think about anything else afterwards. And so my dissertation was entirely on things we could learn about people from Google searches. So I studied racism and child abuse and predicting turnout. That was my dissertation.
In 2006, Google began making its search data public through a tool called Google Trends.
The data is all anonymous and aggregate, so it's how many people make searches in a given city or a given state over some time period.
Steven Stavitowicz's insight, not that he was the only one with this insight, was that within the privacy of their own internet browsers, people are more likely to express their true preferences than they would in the traditional surveys and other data gathering methods that researchers historically use. Those are suspect to what's known as the social desirability bias.
Social desirability bias is basically that you want to look good in a survey. So instead of saying the truth, you say what is desirable. So anything that is socially unacceptable will be underreported in surveys. So a classic example that we know is if you ask people if you voted in the previous election, a huge percentage of the people who don't vote say that they vote because it's considered socially undesirable to not vote in an election.
How then do economists feel about surveys?
Economists kind of hate surveys because you can't really trust what people tell you. You have to see what they actually do. And you have to pay attention to incentives. So a problem with surveys is you don't really have any incentive to tell the truth. Whereas if you're online, you have an incentive to tell the truth to get the information that you actually need.
So considering that most surveys are done either anonymously or with with someone that you have zero repeat transactions with, why do you think the human animal is predisposed toward, protecting or burnishing their reputation, even in a case where the stakes are like they almost couldn't be lower? Why do you think we do that?
People just are in such a habit of lying in their day-to-day life. People lie to their, partners or their kids or their parents that these behaviors kind of carry over in surveys.
Mm. How many lies have you told me already in this conversation? You think like fewer or more than 10?
I think I'm being pretty honest. I actually think that, and listeners can decide whether they agree with this. I think I'm like a compulsively honest person.
You say you're compulsively honest. The title of your book is Everybody Lies. So plainly you're drawing yourself as an outlier.
Well, I could have said like 98% of people lie, but that wouldn't have been a sellable book, right?
So when we are putting out information about ourselves, we may lie, but when we want to find information, via Google, let's say, there's no incentive to lie. That wouldn't get you the results you want. So we open up. We tell Google our secrets.
There are lots of bizarre questions, not just questions, but statements that people make on Google. So, I'm sad or I'm drunk or I love my girlfriend's boobs. Like, why are you telling Google that? I think it feels like kind of a confessional window where people just type statements with no reason that Google would be able to help.
You write in the book, the microscope showed us there's more to a drop of pond water than we think we see. The telescope showed us there's more to the night sky than we think we see. And new digital data now show us there's more to human society than we think we see. So I love that thought. I'm not sure I believe it. in that I'm not sure the ramifications will be so large because, you know, the societal insights you're talking about are often just a refinement or even a confirmation of what we've already learned through centuries of, you know, philosophy and psychology and other fields of inquiry. So tell me why you're so convinced that this revolution will be as big as the others.
Well, I don't think that we're just learning things that we already knew. I think we're learning a lot of things that we had no idea about, the ways in which our intuition was way off about people. So if you talk about, like, what makes people anxious, that's, like, a huge question, right? Like, and I did a couple studies. I said, does anxiety rise after terrorist attacks? And you can see Google searches for anxiety in places after a terrorist attack. They don't seem to rise. And you can say, like, does anxiety rise when Donald Trump is elected? Everyone's saying they're all anxious. There's no rise in anxiety there. So that's, like, pretty much changes how we think about society. Like, that's pretty revolutionary relative to the data we've had on human beings before.
Some of the facts about human nature are unsettling, to say the least. Stevens Davidowitz spent a lot of time looking for racial hatred, as evidenced by the use of the N-word.
In the time period I was studying, it was about as frequent as searches like Migraine and Economist and Lakers and Daily Show. So it wasn't a fringe search by any stretch of the imagination. I think it was about 7 million total searches.
He found that searches like this would rise and fall.
Underwater, here in New Orleans tonight, after the giant storm came the rising waters.
They rose a lot during Hurricane Katrina. There were all these depictions on the media of African-Americans in a real struggle.
An Army National Guard helicopter today rescued people from rooftops, fragile islands in the floodwaters.
It was and the Coast Guard. Disturbingly, people were making an unusually large number of searches mocking African-Americans during that period. And also, they rise a lot every year, Martin Luther King Jr. Day, which is also disturbing.
Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
There was a big increase in searches when Obama was elected.
Hello, Chicago!
That was the week with among the highest searches in the history of Google search for racist material.
If there is anyone out there who still doubts that America is a place where all things are possible.
On the night Obama was elected in 2008, Stevens Davidowitz found that of all the Google searches that included the word Obama, 1% of them also included either the N-word or KKK.
Which may not sound like a huge amount, but 1 in 100, when you think of all the reasons to Google Obama that night. I mean, he's the first black president. You can Google about his victory speech or his family or his history or lots of other things about him. I was pretty shocked by how frequently people found the negative reason to make that search.
And may God bless the United States of America.
So that's when these racist searches were happening. How about where?
That was also surprising. If you had asked me where are racist searches highest in the United States or where is racism in general highest in the United States, I would have said that it's a Southern issue, right? Like you think of the history of the United States, slavery, Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama. And those states are definitely among the highest. But other areas that are right near the top or even at the top, the number one state is West Virginia, and then Pennsylvania, particularly Western Pennsylvania, Eastern Ohio, parts of Michigan is very, very high, industrial Michigan, upstate New York. There's really not a big difference between North versus South. It's East versus West, where it drops substantially once you get west of the Mississippi River, these racist searches.
So let me ask you to just to talk a little bit in more detail about the map of racism and how it related to the last several presidential elections.
Yeah, well, then I was reading this paper by some economists at Berkeley. They were using general social survey data to measure racism. And they had asked the question whether racism played a factor in Obama's vote total in 2008. Even if he won, did he lose votes because of racism? And they concluded, using this general social survey data, that it was not a factor, that racial attitudes were not a big predictor.
But again, learning what we've learned from talking to you today, we have to say, well, wait a minute. Anything like that based on survey data is suspect. Was that your first thought as well?
Yeah, maybe that's suspect. Like, would the Google searches show anything different? So you can't really just compare how many votes Obama got in places where racism is high and racism is low, because those areas may have opposed any Democratic candidate, right? But what you can do is you can compare how did Obama do to the previous Democratic candidate, John Kerry, who was white and had similar views, and how did he compare to other Democratic candidates? And when you do this, you see very, very clearly like a really, really strong relationship that places that make laws to freeze his searches, Obama got substantially fewer votes than other Democratic white Democratic candidates did.
So you're telling us in retrospect that Obama was in some ways an even stronger candidate than he was, right? Winning two elections despite substantial bias against a black candidate?
I calculate they lost about 4 percentage points from racism. He also got about 1 to 2 percentage points from increased African-American turnout. But yeah, on balance, yeah, I think he's like the most charismatic president in history, and charisma counts a lot in politics.
So what does this say generally about overt or public versus covert or private racism?
Well, so over the past 10 or 15 or 20 years in the social sciences, they've been trying to answer a big paradox, which is that African Americans have very, very bad life outcomes, but white people say they're not racist, right? And the traditional answer to this is implicit bias. So like you, I, everybody listening, all of us have some subconscious associations between some negative outcomes and black people. And this has been used to explain why African Americans are struggling. And I think one of the things that this research shows is probably that explicit racism may be playing a bigger role, not this implicit subconscious stereotypes that have dominated the research in the last 20 years or so.
What did your map of racism predict or tell you about the election of Donald Trump?
Well, I didn't actually do this, but Nate Cohn, he's a kind of a stats guy at the New York Times. He got data on Trump support in the Republican primary, and he asked me for the explicit racism data, and he said that it was the biggest predictor he could find of Trump support in the primary was this Google racism data, stronger than education or age or lots of other things.
And what can that tell you, or what can you tell us about Hillary Clinton? I mean, if Obama carried the day twice with the anti-black bias, can you tell us anything about whether the anti-female bias against Hillary Clinton may have been enough to change the outcome?
No, that's like a question. I think I get an email once a week asking me to look into that. I think it's a little bit harder with African Americans. There's pretty much one word that is searched more than every other potentially racist word.
I can think of one word that Hillary's been called a lot that would probably get you fairly far, no?
Well, the issue with sexism is that a lot of the negative words are also porn searches.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, is Seth Stevens Davidowitz's work being acted upon by people in high places?
I think possibly someone from Obama's staff read it because a few weeks later he gave another speech at a Baltimore mosque.
And how often do you have sex?
Several times per week.
Maybe once or twice a week if I'm supposed to average it.
I think that they'll be exaggerating how often they're having sex.
It's coming up right after this break.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by TransferWise, an online service that lets people send and receive money internationally. And their borderless account lets customers hold and convert multiple currencies at any time. More at TransferWise.com and the app. Freakonomics Radio is supported by Progressive Insurance, offering its Home Quote Explorer, designed to provide information about available home insurance options in one place. More information at Progressive.com.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
It was while getting his PhD in economics that Seth Stevens Davidowitz started using Google search data to try to better understand the world. So it seemed natural to use those data for his dissertation. What did his thesis advisors think of this idea?
They all liked it, but they're like, you might not get an academic job.
Did you care about an academic job?
Yeah. I thought I wanted to be a professor, so I did care, but I didn't get one.
Talk about the difficulty of getting the dissertation published.
So it was considered kind of weird to use Google search data, and kind of got some angry responses from journals and the academic markets. I didn't think it was weird, but everyone was telling me it was weird, which is kind of like my life. I'm always weird and don't think I'm weird, so...
Part of his dissertation eventually was published as a paper in the Journal of Public Economics. It was called The Cost of Racial Animus on a Black Presidential Candidate, Evidence Using Google Search Data. It didn't get him a job in academia, but it did help get him a job at Google.
Hal Varian, the chief economist there, he liked my work. He's kind of like also, I think, weird and doesn't realize he's weird, maybe. And he was obsessed with Google data, like, long before I was, and kind of started this whole thing. So we really bonded.
And then what did you do there, and how long were you there?
I was there for about a year and a half. It's kind of like in-house consulting, maybe. Like, Google doesn't really outsource their consulting to, like, McKinsey, or they kind of like having a team inside who understands their data and can help them make decisions.
What kind of Google data were you interpreting and then telling Google about?
A lot of, like, advertising stuff.
Your tone of voice implies lack of thrill. Is that the case?
That's why I quit.
Would you have been able to write the book that you've written? Were you still working at Google?
I think I probably could have, but I maybe would have had to have better social skills to deal with the PR department. So I think my social skills have improved a lot in the last 2 years, but they weren't that great when they... Tact was not in my skill set in my 20s, but...
Give me an example. What do you mean by that?
I just, like, be very aggressive and, like, thought I knew all the answers and stuff, so...
And how old are you now?
34.
So you're done with that phase of your life?
I hope so, yeah.
Talk for a minute about, I guess, your level of confidence or, you know, your argument for the strength of the evidence in that a Google search... is, I would call it sort of a proxy for some behavior or question or activity or whatnot. So it's not the fact itself, it's not the data itself, but it's a query seeming to represent the fact itself. So can you talk for a minute about how substantial you feel the relationship is between the search and the thing? And what gives you that confidence?
There have been a lot of examples where people have correlated searches with real-world behaviors. So there's one study that compares searches for suicide, and these correlate highly with actual suicides. And the Google searches for suicide correlate much higher than surveys for suicide. I've done research on, you can predict how many people will turn out to vote based on whether people search where to vote or how to vote before an election. These correlate higher and much higher than surveys with how many people actually turn out to vote. These crazy searches, kill Muslims, and like these really nasty searches about Muslims, I've shown with Evan Soltas then at Princeton that these correlate with hate crimes against Muslims. So I think the fact that over and over again they correlate and usually correlate much stronger than other data sets is proof that even some of the stranger searches have real information in them.
Real information that may, in some cases, be useful.
So if you're talking about people who search kill Muslims or I hate Muslims, this is not, you know, your average American. This is someone with extreme animosity and rage and violent thoughts. So this kind of unique sample of people, even if it's small, would be basically impossible to capture in a survey or to find in a university laboratory experiment. But because Google searches have everybody, they also have this small, tiny mob, and we can study really for maybe the first time what actually inflames an angry mob and what actually calms down an angry mob.
As we heard earlier, anti-Muslim searches rose when President Obama was trying to calm things down after the San Bernardino attack.
ISIL does not speak for Islam. They are thugs and killers.
But in the last few minutes of that speech, the president changed tack.
Obama talked about how Muslim Americans are American heroes.
Muslim Americans are our friends and our neighbors, our co-workers, our sports heroes. And yes, they are our men and women in uniform who are willing to die in defense of our country.
A nation of Googlers also changed tack.
You saw for the first time in many years, the top descriptor of Muslims on Google was not Muslim terrorists or Muslim refugees, it was Muslim athletes and Muslim soldiers. They both skyrocketed and stayed up about a week afterwards.
He was collaborating on this project with Evan Soltas.
So what Evan and I concluded was maybe lecturing people is not the best way to change their mind or to calm them down if they're enraged, but subtly provoking their curiosity, offering a new description of a group that is causing them so much angst, is maybe more effective. And then we wrote this up in the New York Times. It got some attention. And I think possibly someone from Obama's staff read it because a few weeks later, he gave another speech at a Baltimore mosque.
Please be seated.
And he really stopped with all the lectures and the sermon, and he instead focused much more on the curiosity provoking. So he talked about how not just Muslim athletes and Muslim soldiers, but he talked about Muslim firefighters and Muslim teachers, and how Thomas Jefferson had a copy of the Quran, and how Muslim Americans built the skyscrapers in Chicago.
Generations of Muslim Americans helped to build our nation. They were part of the flow of immigrants who became farmers and merchants.
So he kind of doubled down or quadrupled down on this curiosity strategy. And it does seem like right after these words were spoken, the angry searches about Muslim Americans actually went down. So there was a drop in searches for kill Muslims and I hate Muslims after Obama gave this speech.
Stevens Davidowitz's book is stuffed with examples of the behaviors that, according to him, everybody lies about, especially on traditional surveys. So we recruited some Freakonomics Radio listeners, promised them anonymity, and asked them some typical survey questions. And we asked Stevens Davidowitz to predict what they would say. So if we asked people how frequently they have sex, what do you think they would say?
I think men will say about 1.5 times a week, and women will say about once a week.
It varies from week to week, maybe once or twice a week, if I'm supposed to average it.
I would say maybe 3 or 4 times a month,
several times per week.
And then how does that compare to the reality, as best we know?
I think that they'll both be exaggerating how often they're having sex.
And how do you know that they're exaggerating?
I did this comparison. The general social survey asks men and women how frequently they have sex and whether they use a condom. And if you do the math on that, then American men say they use 1.6 billion condoms in heterosexual sexual encounters. And American women use 1.1 billion condoms in heterosexual sexual encounters. And obviously those by definition have to be the same, right? So like, you know already that someone's lying. But then I got data from Nielsen on how many condoms are sold every year in the United States, and only 600 million condoms are sold every year. And that doesn't mean that they're lying about how much sex they're having. They might just be having more unprotected sex. But if you actually look at like the best math on how frequently people get pregnant, if people are having as much unprotected sex as they say they're having, there'd be more pregnancies every year in the United States.
Right. Although then you have to factor in terminations as well, correct?
Yeah, even including how many abortions there are.
So in other words, bottom line is people lie a lot to a significant degree. Like, what would you put the rate of exaggeration at for sex generally, sex frequency?
Like 3 to 1 for men and 2 to 1 for women.
Wow. If we ask people if they watch pornography, what will they say and how accurate will that be?
I thought that everybody would say yes, because I thought that in this day and age, at least the males would be okay saying that they watch pornography.
No, no, no.
Yes. Is everybody just saying no?
On occasion. I think everybody has urges that need to be fulfilled.
I had no clue you guys would ask me that. I just don't. I never have.
Women make up about 20% of pornography views now, so that's probably some deception there.
So we asked a bunch of people if they think Super Bowl ads make them more likely to buy the product that's being advertised. What do you think they'll say, and what's the reality?
I think they'll probably say no, because people don't like to think that they're influenced by ads.
No.
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 I think they increase the awareness, but I don't find many of the Super Bowl ads relevant to me.
When I'm looking to buy a product, I don't at least consciously think that I get my information for it from commercials.
The reality is definitely yes. The way people have studied this is comparing product purchases in cities of teams that made it versus cities that just missed the Super Bowl. So you get a big shock to viewership, and those cities end up buying those advertised products much more. So they're clearly very effective.
All right, Seth. I think you make a very persuasive argument that Google search data is, you know, a great tool to figure out who we are and what we care about and so on, especially when it's not going to be revealed in a more traditional way. But obviously, Google search data hardly reveals everything. So I'd like you to just tell us one thing that's provocative or embarrassing or surprising about you that we will never, ever be able to learn from a Google search. How does it feel now, huh?
That's all right. One thing that's embarrassing or surprising about me that you never learn from a Google search.
You have to get back to us on that? You want to get back to us by email? We can note that there were like 18 seconds of incredibly awkward silence followed by an email a week later. That's fine.
Okay.
A week later, to the day, Seth Stevens Davidowitz did send an email. Subject line, embarrassing thing I have never Googled. The email read, quote, I am embarrassed and insecure about how I sleep. I've been told I twitch and jerk like a maniac. For some reason, I've never Googled this particular issue, but it is possible someone who has shared a bed with me has. In case you are curious, the top three Googled complaints about male partners are that he talks, twitches, and jerks in his sleep. The top three Googled complaints about female partners are that she talks, farts, and masturbates in her sleep. End quote. Coming up next on Freakonomics Radio, if you think lying is common, what about gossip?
The average person might tell three lies every 10 minutes, and it wouldn't surprise me if gossip were equally common.
That's coming up. If you want to hear some of the more than 350 Freakonomics Radio episodes we've made in the past, you can find them at Freakonomics.com. You can also subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Abacus, a real-time expense reporting software designed to reimburse team members, reconcile corporate cards, and implement expense policies without expense reports. More information at abacus.com/freak.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Thomas Corley has made a habit, a career, really, of studying the difference between rich people and poor people.
44% of the wealthy wake up 3 hours before work starts versus 3% for the poor.
Corley is an accountant and a financial planner in New Jersey. He wrote a book called Rich Habits, The Daily Success Habits of Wealthy Individuals. He did 5 years worth of research.
I interviewed 233 wealthy people and 128 poor people. And when I was done, there was about 149 metrics that I followed or I tracked.
By wealthy, Corley means annual income over $160,000 and net liquid assets of $3.2 million. By poor, he means income less than $35,000 and net liquid assets of less than $5,000. There were a lot of differences between these two groups.
Wealthy people spend 30 minutes or more every morning doing technical reading, some type of technical self-improvement reading.
They also keep track of things.
Oh, 81% of the wealthy maintain a to-do list versus 19% for the poor.
Corley found that rich people exercise more and eat healthier.
97% of the poor people in my study ate more than 300 junk food calories a day. 70% of the wealthy ate less than 300 junk food calories per day.
It's worth noting that these findings come from one man's survey. It's much more old school than Seth Stevens Davidowitz's big data research approach. But there are some surprising results that are worth exploring. But you know what Corley found that really surprised him? It has to do with... Here, I'll give you a hint. Hey. Did you hear
about... I mean, I think they're always jacked up. It's like...
Well, we were gossiping about that.
But I have some real piece of gossip that I always want to talk about.
Okay. I heard that she was pregnant.
Everyone heard about it.
And he tries to sleep with everyone at the post office.
Okay, I really need to talk about the certain someone in our dance class.
Yeah, please! I know exactly who it is.
Do you really?
6% of the wealthy gossip. Compare that to 79% of the poor who gossip. This is one of those habits that really sticks out like that Grand Canyon of differences that I saw. This is one that really sends that message home that wealthy people and poor people do certain things differently on a daily basis. Gossip happens to be one of them.
We're talking about gossip, what it is and what it's not, the characteristics of the people who produce and consume gossip, and the functions of gossip, all of which sounds fairly scientific, yes? Well, let me lower your expectations. We came into this thinking we could answer these questions scientifically, and we will poke into what science there is on the topic, but honestly, there isn't much good science about gossip yet, which is sort of surprising considering how long gossip has been around, which, if we had to guess, is about as long as humans have been around. And, of course,
everybody consumes and produces gossip.
That's Jenny Cole. She's a senior psychology lecturer at Manchester Metropolitan University.
And my research interests are in gossip and communication.
Well, so are mine today. We wanted to talk to Jenny Cole about the difference between good gossip and bad gossip, and how each of them makes us feel. Cole, along with one of her students, Hannah Scrivener, ran some experiments. They started by showing people a photo of someone they didn't know.
So in the first experiment, people were presented with a photo and just a really brief description of sort of hobbies and demographic information. And they were asked to describe that person. So in essence, gossip is describing someone positively or negatively mm-hmm. when they're not there. Mm-hmm. So we thought this is almost what gossip is about, if we boil gossip down to the essentials. And participants actually were quite willing to give descriptions of people they had no idea about. We thought they'd complain about this, and they seemed to be quite happy to do it. And we found that when you gossip about someone, or when you take part in this type of task where you're asked to describe someone in a positive way, there's not much effect on how we feel about ourselves. We're not that bothered whether we're saying mm-hmm. something positive about someone or not.
So it doesn't make us feel better to praise someone, in other
no,
words?
No, it yeah? doesn't. Okay. But it does make us feel much worse if we criticize someone when they're not there. And this is even someone that we don't know, just someone we've been presented with in an experiment.
Okay, just to recap, saying something nice does nothing for us. Saying something nasty makes us feel bad. Now, in the next experiment Cole ran, she added another task.
So I had another task in the second experiment, which was a bit closer to what you might think of as gossip. So people were asked to share with the experimenter in written form something positive or negative about someone that they knew. So almost like to tell a little story.
So in each case, a subject was asked for either a positive or a negative. Is that the way you separated
yes,
them out?
Okay. Yes. Mm-hmm. So some of the participants were encouraged to, you know, tell us a little story about something that makes their acquaintance or friend that they're talking about look good. And half were asked to tell a little story about something that made their friend or acquaintance look bad.
And just so I'm clear, sorry. So the differences are A, you're being directed to either go positive or negative.
Yep.
And B, you're now describing someone real that you actually know instead of some fake person whose picture you've seen.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. All right. Yep. What do you find now?
Well, now you find that regardless of whether the description is positive or negative, everyone feels bad, basically. Everyone feels bad if they talk about someone behind their back, regardless of what they're saying.
Okay, so in a nutshell, you find that if you ask a bunch of college students who come into a lab mm-hmm. to describe someone they see for the first time in a picture, someone they don't know, mm-hmm. you find that saying positive things about that person doesn't change their feelings about themselves, but it does make them feel worse if they say something negative.
Yes, absolutely.
When, however, you ask these same people to say something either positive or negative about someone that they actually do know, a real person, then they feel worse whether they say something positive or negative.
Yes. Mm.
Now, you mentioned in the first leg, in the first portion of your study, where people are shown a picture and gossip about someone, that they feel worse about themselves when they say something negative. Mm-hmm. If that's the case, is it irrational somehow to want to do that? Is it wrong? I guess that's not the word I really want, but we'll stick with irrational. Is it irrational to do something of your own volition that makes you feel worse? And if not, why?
I think that's part of the reason why gossip is so fascinating, because we do it all the time. You know, estimates will vary about how much we do it. But it does seem sort of irrational. There's lots of studies that show that if you present someone with a person who gossips and you ask that person how much they like them, then people don't like gossips very much. Mm-hmm. And also, my research suggests that there might be a sort of personal disadvantage as well, in terms of you don't feel very good about yourselves. So it seems, if you don't look at it further, like gossip is an impossible human behaviour.
From what we've heard so far, there's not much good to say about gossip, is there? people don't like people who gossip. When we do it, it makes us feel bad about ourselves. So it's tempting to just write off gossip as an inevitable and rotten byproduct of the human condition. But what if we told you that gossip served some really useful functions?
I'm Adam Grant, a Wharton professor and organizational psychologist. I study how relationships influence success, and recent focus is on gossip.
All right, Adam Grant, tell us this for starters. Just how common is gossip?
How common is it? Estimates vary. I think it's an interesting comparison with lying research. So Bella DiPaolo and her colleagues have estimated that the average person might tell 3 lies every 10 minutes. And it wouldn't surprise me if gossip were equally common.
And what function does all that gossip serve? Grant says it's a social lubricant, for one, but that it's more than that. Pro-social gossip, as academics call it, has a more important function.
Beyond the social lubrication, I think there's another piece that's quite important, which is gossip is a warning device. It's a way that we can actually protect the people around us against the folks that I've come to call the takers, who are selfish and out for themselves. So let's go back to Enron, and let's look at what happened when Ken Lay decided to form Enron and had a series of moments where he essentially stacked the Enron board with a bunch of his cronies and sort of buried a series of very selfish behaviors from his prior employer. And then a number of people at Enron start to realize that this guy is all about himself, and they say nothing. They don't spread the word. They don't tell anybody else that this is somebody who doesn't have the company's best interests at heart, who's going to do some kind of harm or violence to shareholders and stakeholders. And of course, the company manages to swindle lots of people out of their jobs and others out of their life savings. I think in that case, I look at that and say, if somebody had been willing to step up earlier, whistleblowing is an extreme form of pro-social gossip. And that could have saved us from Enron and many other situations like it.
I guess the skeptic in me says, well, they're not willing to blow a whistle because their interests are tied with his at that point. If they know it's going to go down the hole, then of course they'd be more likely to. But at that point, they're thinking, we're all on this profitable ride together and wouldn't make any sense for me to put that forth.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And I think that's where the lack of gossip is basically at odds with what's good for the group. And if we could cultivate a stronger level of concern for saying, look, let's try to make sure that everybody's best interests here are at heart, then we actually get somebody who's more likely to step up and spread a little bit of pro-social gossip.
Well, both rumor and gossip, this is one of the silver linings of any of the negative side effects of rumor, is this detecting of cheaters, detecting of freeloaders, detecting of people who are harmful to the group in some way.
That's Nicholas DeFonso. He's a professor of psychology at the Rochester Institute of Technology. He studies rumor, and yes, there is an academic distinction between rumor and gossip, although for the purposes of this conversation, that's a distinction without a difference.
And so if you have done something that's bad for your group, then that's one of the good functions of rumor and gossip, is that your group will find out.
DeFonso says that paying attention to rumors and gossip is an excellent way to police a community.
Well, the intelligence agencies classify one kind of intelligence as rumor. I believe the term is rumor int. So they're very conscious of unverified information that's in circulation.
Throughout history, especially during wartime, rumor and gossip have been used to gain an edge.
Propaganda rumors, rumors that are purposely started for a strategic goal or military gain, were used throughout World War II. We have declassified documents, manuals, written in part by Robert Knapp, who was a professor at that time. And he advised the Allies about how to spread rumors that would demoralize the German troops or confuse the Axis powers.
Gossip and rumor are part of modern-day warfare, too.
During the Iraq War, Saddam Hussein regularly used rumors. In fact, the weapons of mass destruction rumors that most people say got us into Iraq probably were started by Saddam Hussein in order to make his enemies afraid and or by Iraqi expatriates who wanted to get back into Iraq and wanted the U.S. to become involved in Iraq. So that was a very successful rumor campaign.
Yes, there was a rumor that we had a special ray that made Saddam Hussein talk. There's just lots of rumors about him. So there were some rumors that he was working on negotiating a special deal with the U.S., that he was already in captivity, but we were waiting to announce it so that it would fit our political cycle.
That's Lieutenant Colonel Stephanie Kelly.
I'm an active duty Air Force officer, and obviously anything I have to say is my own opinion. I'm not speaking on behalf of the Air Force, but I'm here to talk about a thesis that I wrote when I was a student at the Naval Postgraduate School in 2004.
The thesis was called Rumors in Iraq, A Guide to Winning Hearts and Minds.
And so I was trying to compare these two counterinsurgency tactics, and I realized that I had no way of assessing the perception of the Iraqi people.
Kelly came across a publication called The Baghdad Mosquito. It was published by American intelligence officials with the help of some Iraqis and Arab American translators. These folks would mine Iraqi news sources for the latest gossip and publish a column in English.
I think the column was entitled What's the Word on the Street in Baghdad? So it was pretty obvious.
Kelly saw this as a great resource.
So I would get these publications every day and the weekly Baghdad Mosquitoes that had the rumor section in that, I would pull those out and I would log each rumor into an Excel spreadsheet. And then after looking at all of these rumors, just certain categories became obvious. And then I would just go through and I categorized all of the rumors by the broad subject, whether they were inciting hostility or fear, or if it was a positive spin, like a wish rumor, or if it was just relaying some generic information. And then basically I just counted them. I categorized all the rumors. There was almost 1,000 of them over a 10-month period. And they really ran the gamut of a lot of different subjects.
Some of the gossip was silly, even absurd, but not all of it.
So there was some rumors that talked about threats against people that collaborated with the U.S. There was rumors about some of the crimes that were being committed, like people were being kidnapped. There was rumors just about what was going on with the formation of the transitional government. And then there were some interesting, kind of funny rumors, things like the United States Army was going to turn a mosque into an amusement park, or that when Saddam Hussein was captured, they used a sleeping agent to knock him out before they went in, and a sheep herder in nearby fields said his sheep fell asleep for a week and they didn't wake up, and that's how they knew this rumor was true. Things like that. So there were some funny things, but there was also some rumors that were worrisome. So there were some that the soldiers were handing out candy to children that were poisoned, or that they were purposefully going to Iraq and affecting the population with AIDS. So there was a lot of rumors that incited fear in the population and actually fomented like a divide between the Iraqi people and the U.S. forces.
So what did Kelly conclude? That gossip is a free and valuable resource that shouldn't be ignored. Paying attention to what people are saying, even if a lot of it seems like petty gossip or rumor, could have changed the way that American troops were perceived in Iraq. Now, unfortunately, much of what was reported in the Baghdad Mosquito was dismissed as idle chatter. Kind of the way that we dismiss a lot of celebrity gossip in this country.
What were your thoughts when someone named Courtney from The Bachelor revealed everything about your hookup in her book? Did you know about this? I mean, if someone wrote about a hookup, I guess that's what you want them to say.
Right? I mean, you're always, you know, on the edge of your seat waiting for something bad to be revealed about you. And then every once in a while, you know, it's not so bad.
Right.
Well, we live in dichotomy, right? So I don't think gossip is purely bad.
Adrian Grenier is a movie star and a TV star who played a movie star, Vincent Chase, in Entourage.
It's not all good either if indulged too much, but it does serve its usefulness. It's a way for us to share ideas, and through these stories of other people, through celebrity antics or missteps, we get to together share what we think is right or wrong and form moral judgments. And I think that can be a good thing.
What's it like to be the subject of gossip? I mean, when you're in a show like Entourage and you're a big star like you are, I'm guessing you hear and read things about you that may be wildly untrue and maybe hurtful. What's that like?
Well, I think a lot of actors and performers forget their role. They forget that they are, in fact, in the public eye because they are performers and they're vehicles for ideas. And I embrace it personally. I understand that that's what I chose to do is through acting and through the other things I do, I'm putting myself out there to create stories or tell stories that ultimately generate thought and put forth ideas. And it's really a service, a public service, and I really am a servant of the people. So people have the right to talk about me or talk about the things I've done, and I don't take it personally.
So you sound incredibly easygoing about accepting the bad with the good. Is it hard to do that? Or do you really kind of zen out on it and just say, yeah, people can say what they say because I've put myself in this arena?
I think zen out is the right term because it is, I think, a spiritual thing. It's, you know, I'd consider myself a Buddhist above all spiritual practices, and really, you know, contentment or happiness is really in the mind. So I don't really, you know, I take everything outside in the outside world with a grain of salt, including gossip. And but at the same time, you know, it's a great way for me to keep myself in check. You know, if you can, you know, with a grain of salt, look at what people are saying, and maybe there's some value there. Maybe I shouldn't have said that, or maybe I can correct my behavior. And even looking at other celebrities and what they do or they don't do, it helps me sort of guide my own behavior.
So there's some research that seems to indicate that people who gossip, or when people gossip, afterwards they feel worse, their self-esteem falls. It seems like a thing of value to have. I have something that I'm going to tell other people, and it will either titillate them or shock them or make them laugh, and therefore I get something out of it. But it may be, and I put emphasis on the may, it may be that that activity, while it seems like it's going to bring me a benefit, actually costs me. Does that seem right to you or no?
Well, what seems right to me is that maybe there's a momentary endorphin rush, then you crash from that endorphin rush maybe, and you can't sustain happiness on that. You know, I think, you know, ideas and creating value and being, you know, being a servant to your community and connected to your friends and really creating value for the world is, I think, where you derive happiness.
I guess I work in a kind of a sewing circle-esque place where we have lots of gossip.
I think gossiping is really satisfying.
It is.
Gossiping can get you into trouble. Generally, if I hear gossip, it goes one ear and out the other.
I mean,
it's
you
like
gossip
bond,
for a
you
while,
really bond.
And you're just like, oh, I feel so much better,
yeah,
you know?
You get it out, totally.
I guess it's gossiping. For me, it's just sharing knowledge.
So to Adrienne Grenier, gossip is a two-way street. And here's how the psychologist Jenny Cole defines gossip.
Gossip is describing someone positively or negatively when they're not there.
And Adam Grant from Wharton.
Beyond the social lubrication, I think there's another piece that's quite important, which is gossip is a warning device.
And let's not forget Stephanie Kelly, talking about gossip, or if you insist, rumor, in Iraq.
So there were some that the soldiers were handing out candy to children that were poisoned, or that they were purposefully going to Iraq and affecting the population with AIDS.
Isn't it strange that this one thing, gossip, can have so many different definitions? I guess that's one reason why our understanding of it isn't very scientific yet. But there's probably another reason, which is that for all the functions that gossip can serve, good and bad, we seem to have a cultural aversion to acknowledging that, acknowledging the legitimacy and the power of it. That's also why most of us probably gossip a lot more than we think, a lot more than we'd admit. Remember what Adam Grant told us about the research on lying and gossip?
Bella DiPaolo and her colleagues have estimated that the average person might tell 3 lies every 10 minutes. And it wouldn't surprise me if gossip were equally common.
Of course, for that to be true, every hour of conversation would contain 18 lies, a rate bordering on pathological. But look at it this way. If you come right out and admit that you gossip, at least that's one less lie you'll be telling. I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. We'll be back next week. If you don't want to wait, subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or any other app. Our entire archive can be found at freakonomics.com or on Stitcher. As always, thanks for listening.